Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Looking for a new high-end mascara without breaking the bank? The new L'Oreal Paris Panorama Mascara gives you a high-end lash look in a premium gold luxe packaging. It's all about panoramic volume and fully fanned out lashes. With its tapered brush, the new Panorama Mascara catches every single lash, giving you the false lash look without any of the hassle. Say goodbye to clumps and flakes, because this mascara is specially formulated to resist them all day with up to 24-hour wear. And the best part? It performs better than luxe mascaras at only a fraction of the cost. You can buy Panorama Mascara on Amazon today.
This is the John Fugelsang Podcast.
I am so thrilled to welcome our guest, not because he's one of the UK's most distinguished historians, but because his new book is a powerful read that also makes an incredible gift for the history lover in your life. Cyrian Kershaw is the author of To Hell and Back, The End, Making Friends with Hitler, and he is one of the greatest British historians of 20th century Europe. He's written several biographies of Adolf Hitler. In 2002, he received his knighthood for services to history. He is a fellow of the British Academy, the Royal Historical Society, and his new book asks the question, how far can a single leader change the course of human history? And how do these leaders use what we call personalities that sometimes give them the ability to do whatever they wish? The book is Personality and Power, Builders and Destroyers of Modern Europe. And it's an incredible study in which Cyrian Kershaw looks at 12 major historical figures, 4 dictators, Lenin, Stalin, Hitler, Mussolini, a couple of national autocrats, Tito and Franco, and then democratic leaders, Margaret Thatcher, Helmut Kohl, De Gaulle, Churchill, and for me, most fascinatingly, Mikhail Gorbachev, a man who rose in a totalitarian system and then ultimately helped destroy it. It's an amazing book about how strikingly different figures wielded power. It is a great pleasure to welcome Cyrian Kershaw to SiriusXM.
Hello, it's a great pleasure to be with you this afternoon and to look forward to our discussion.
Well, thank you. I'm very, very grateful for your time. One of your early works, The Hitler Myth, really showed how Hitler's power was dependent on the image, the propaganda, and the public perception. But of course, there's no way to understate this theory of charismatic leadership, the charisma of the leader. And it's created by the following of his true believers who somehow believe that he or she is to some degree a chosen one. And of course, you point out very often these images are manufactured by a movement or manufactured by the state. I'm very curious, sir, to begin, what was it that made you want to adopt this format in the new book, these dozen profiles, half of them dictators and the other Democrats, who all shaped the 20th century in Europe?
The key criterion that I had for the choice was, did each of these individuals affect significantly the history of Europe in the 20th century? And once I looked at that question and answered it in the affirmative, say, yes, each of these individuals did personally affect the history of Europe, then they figured as characters in this book. So that was my key element of choice then, as to how important they were as makers of history in Europe. And in each case, these are not mini biographies, but they're an attempt to understand how these individuals gain power and exercise that power. And the key thing then is, to what extent was their impact such that they personally affected history, changed history for millions of individuals.
And in that writing, you, of course, give us all new biographies of these figures and really allow us to view them in very different ways through the prism of the power and how they wielded it. You begin the book with Karl Marx in 1852, when he said, "Men make their own history, but not as they please, in conditions of their own choosing, but rather under those directly encountered, given, and inherited. In your research, sir, how far is a leader's power shaped by personality, and how much is it shaped by circumstance? There really doesn't seem to be any absolute formula, is there?
There is no formula. You can't reduce it to a mathematical formula, so many percentage personality, so many percentage impersonal structural components. But I did find the quotation from Karl Marx that you just read out very instructive in this direction, that I've never been a Marxist, but I thought that the way in which Marx put the question there, put the point anyway, with regard to the person he was looking at, Louis Bonaparte, whom he thought was an absolute zero in terms of his personality and everything. So Marx was actually trying to understand how an individual like that, who was not by any stretch of the imagination a great figure in his view, but rather a clown who happened to be in the right position at the right time to gain the support of people to take power in France. Now that, if you apply that and then look at it, although we can't work out mathematically any formula for this, what we can say is the obvious point that people are both made by the conditions in which they're faced, but also they shape the conditions that they inherit in new ways. So that if you take the individuals that I'm concerned with now, each of them comes to power in the form of crisis. And the deeper the crisis, the greater the potential for that individual to have an impact on history. And if we look at the impact of Lenin, of Stalin, of Hitler, of Churchill, then we see obviously these individuals did, through their own actions, affect the lives of millions of Europeans and to some extent of people outside Europe. They were all the product of specific conditions, and without those conditions, these individuals would not have come to power. So it's a combination of both, and although we're not unable to measure it, we can say the structural conditions present individuals who have an instinct for power with a certain opportunities to utilize their personal character traits and then make their own mark on history. They are makers of history, but they're also made by it.
That's what's completely fascinating. And of course, Americans have no idea how to relate to the concept of a clown in the right place at the right time getting power.
I can imagine.
Yeah. I did find it fascinating, though, to see what were the conditions, what were the crises that allowed different autocrats or Democrats to attain power. Obviously, in the case of Hitler, you've got this incredible economic depression. In the case of Mussolini, you've got the collapse of parliament in Italy. And in the case of Lenin, it's just a broad social revolution. On the other hand, some of these leaders that we now consider successful are ones who rose up to fight the crises created by Hitler or Mussolini. Certainly Churchill and De Gaulle are viewed as saviors of their nation because of how they responded to the crisis of war.
That's absolutely correct. The crises spawned different crises, and the leaders that you just mentioned, Churchill and De Gaulle in particular, were leaders who came to the fore in conditions in which they thrived in contending with the mega crisis that they faced at the time. Churchill, after all, his entire reputation, the reputation that lasts to this very day, and people think in Britain but elsewhere of Churchill as one of the great 20th century leaders, that reputation depends very heavily, if not completely, upon his time as war leader during the Second World War, and in particular on his role in 1940. And we have to bear in mind that Churchill, when he was made Prime Minister in May 1940, was the first choice, neither the Conservative Party, in which his reputation was actually quite checkered at the time, nor of the King of England. So Churchill came to power in very unpropitious circumstances, with the German army threatening to invade the country, Britain at the lowest ebb in its entire history, and yet he contended with that crisis, he surmounted it, he was the person who basically mastered that immediate crisis, and Britain fought on. And it wasn't a foregone conclusion that Britain would fight on, because the main other contender for power, Lord Halifax, actually wanted to make overtures towards a possible peace settlement with Mussolini and later on with Hitler. And the history of Britain, of Europe, and of the world outside would have been very different if Halifax had been Prime Minister instead of Churchill. The same with de Gaulle. He came to power in very unpropitious circumstances. First of all, as the leader of a small number of exiled Frenchmen in Britain, and then gradually, as the war turned against Germany, became the seen as the more widely as the leader of the Free French, and then subsequently, of course, he became the leader of France, president of France in peacetime when he came to deal with a second crisis, that of the Algerian War in the late 1950s and early 1960s. So these figures came to power faced with massive crisis. The way they reacted to crisis and the personality traits that they had enabled them to react to crisis were the key factors, and that has meant that these individuals have lasting, and deservedly lasting, reputations as very significant figures in their country's history.
Indeed, but what I found so interesting and repeatedly compelling was how, as we know, anyone who's lived through the Cold War or lived through the Iraq War, these crises can be fabricated as well. I will admit I didn't know much about the war scare in Russia in 1927 when Pravda was publishing fake news that Britain was going to invade the USSR. And this was what helped enable Stalin to gain leadership. It was just fear based on rumor, conjecture, and lies.
Yes, that's right. And the fact that these systems were still so fragile and so unconsolidated also enabled them, of course, to benefit from crisis upon crisis of the way you've just described. And so you can, the bigger the crisis, the more potential then the leader who came to power had to forge the future of his own country, and it was his in every case except for the one, Mrs. Thatcher, and in this book. So it explains in different ways the path to power of each of the individuals. And yet, of course, they needed certain characteristics in order to exploit that crisis to their own ends and to gain power in the first place before they could actually utilize it. And the personality traits were the individuals were different, although there were some common factors to it as well.
What is interesting for Americans is that we just survived an election where we're getting very used to a lot of these manufactured crises. Obviously, here we're told routinely by certain politicians to be terrified of the migrants at the border, or trans children are going to ruin girls' sports, or China deliberately released a virus. It seems like this has always been a constant in political thinking and campaigning to try to have these existential, often fabricated crises. How did Mussolini do it? I mean, did Mussolini just use fear of communism to allow him to rally all the frightened Catholics to get behind him?
Yes, he certainly did. And utilized the fear, not just utilized, but embroidered and enhanced the fear of communism, which actually was a very minor fear, that very minor factor in Italian politics. The communists were nowhere near gaining power, but Mussolini was able to suggest that they were an imminent threat, and to exploit that in the interest of the still young fascist movement, and that the elaborated fear of outsiders or of internal enemies has been a feature of the rise to power of autocrats and dictators wherever they are, and of course to continue with that that attack on internal enemies once they've gained power. You see that par excellence in the case of Hitler, but you see it in all these dictatorships that I'm dealing with here. Stalin, for example, is paranoia.
Yes.
Outright paranoia about enemies, external and internal, the way in which he continued to search for and eventually to destroy Trotsky in exile in Mexico in 1940. But Trotsky had figured as the sort of the key fear element for as regards Stalin, the boo man in Russian Soviet politics, the person who had to be sought out and destroyed. And that was a feature of the politics in modern fashion with, at that time, the modern technology that Mussolini and Hitler exploited fully, the use of radio and of of newspapers. Of course, now we're in the era of 24/7 news and social media and the internet, very different media landscape than that which existed at the time. But fake news, although the term fake news is recent, what these dictators were doing, and other autocratic leaders too, was utilizing fake news at the time to to develop the bogeyman of the internal enemy that needed to be destroyed. So fake news is nothing new, even if the term itself is.
Yes, Hitler called it the Lügenpresse, right? The lying press?
That's right. Yeah, indeed, he did. Yes, and Goebbels was, his propaganda minister was the expert in the notion of the lying press, and the bigger the lie, the more effective it would be if it were told often enough, was Goebbels' motto, and he put that into operation. And that was the case in Nazi Germany, but it was also the case in these other dictatorships too. So, nothing new in that regard except the term, I think.
We're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back. This is Progress.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
You know, it's interesting. When you group these successful, charismatic, democratic leaders with these successful fascist dictators, you write about all of them. Each had extraordinary determination, strength of character to surmount hardship and setbacks, a relentless will to succeed, and a level of egocentrism that demanded extreme loyalty and subordinated everybody and everything to the attainment of desired goals. They were all driven individuals. Right now, Americans are witnessing this transition where the supporters of Donald Trump are beginning to pledge blind obedience to the governor of Florida. It is fascinating to see how, for so many of these leaders throughout history, it all came down to a personality cult. It seems like that's essential for the success of any of these individuals.
Yes, it is. But of course, as you've just been implying, once the individuals have managed to gain power, then they have at their disposal the mass media, and in the case of these dictators that I'm dealing with, of course, monopolistic control of the mass media.
Yes.
But even today now, as you saw in the Trump presidency, the way in which he was able to utilize Twitter, for example, for his own ends, and so on, depend upon the build-up of a personality cult. In fact, we live in an era where personality, whether it's sporting personalities or pop stars or whatever, seem to be the center of all attention. So It's natural then that politicians, much more than was the case with democratic politicians for the most part in the 20th century, I think, with one or two notable exceptions. But now politicians have to operate within a type of personality cult, an invented or manufactured personality cult, and sometimes that develops quite shameless levels, as it did in Britain with the way in which a personality cult was built up around Boris Johnson, for instance.
Yes.
So personality is highlighted by modern media in sometimes ways which are different from the 20th century, obviously, but which have in a way the same goal, to focus all the political attention on one individual and bring out that individual's real or manufactured personality traits.
I found it fascinating to learn details about Franco, like how he just wore down his own ministers by having these cabinet meetings that would last all day, all night, and not allow toilet breaks. I mean, you describe Franco's bladder control as extraordinary.
Yes, I was struck by that too, that he was able to last out for 7-hour cabinet meetings without ever needing to go to the bathroom, and these poor cabinet ministers were often in agony as they were resting. In fact, they didn't dare to ask permission to go, and yet just had to sit there and suffer. And of course, when about in the early 1970s, Franco then interrupted a cabinet meeting to go to the bathroom himself, everybody knew that was the end of the regime couldn't be far away. So it's just a little anecdotal detail, but it does actually say something about the way in which these dictators have to protect their own image somehow. That it's the same with other leaders, that Hitler used to stand for hours for march past of the Wehrmacht. He could hardly interrupt those. Hang on just a minute, I need to disappear out to the bathroom. So in all these cases, then, although it's a humorous, semi-humorous comment I'm making in the book there, but there is an element. Dictators have to behave in particular ways to enhance their public persona, the image that the propaganda has created for them. And Franco, although the bladder control issue was not one which was appealed to the press at the time, nonetheless, in a way, it does say something indirectly about the way in which leading personalities have to behave in public.
Mm-hmm. And it builds the myth as well. I want to ask you briefly about Mrs. Thatcher, because it's interesting the way you describe her and what her personal charisma lent to her political movement, how she thrived on abrasive argument and combative dispute. She had workaholic habits and forensic interrogative powers as a lawyer to carry her case against cabinet colleagues who were less well-prepared or more submissive in their character. We have plenty of politicians like that in America, but they're not successful. What was it that allowed Margaret Thatcher to have these traits, which, again, could be quite irritating in an incompetent American senator, and yet it drove her to the prime minister?
Well, what enabled her to do it was the fact that she managed to gain power against the odds, in a way. She was a woman in a man's political world, and she came from a provincial market town in England, which was not the usual background for conservative politicians. And she really managed to come to power despite these two significant disadvantages. And once in power, then, she had the stubbornness, the resilience, the determination, and also the argumentative skills to be able to sustain herself against opposition within her own cabinet. So I think it's the fact that once these people are in power, then their personality traits really come to the fore, because they have then the aura of power attached to them. It's then far less easy to dismiss these people as could be done in opposition. And so Mrs. Thatcher then was able to do that in the early 1980s against significant opposition and push through what were very unpopular policies until, in certain ways, fortune came to her aid with the Falklands War of 1982, which saw her popularity, which was then rocky in Britain. Her popularity momentarily rose very considerably. She was helped by a split on the left of the political spectrum, and was able then to increase her majority in the 1983 election. And as happens with so many of these people who are in power for a long period of time, then the power itself begins to go to their head. They believe in their own infallibility, and she made big mistakes towards the end of her time in office. But that's, I think, many people have these character traits but don't get anywhere near power. Once they do, then it's much more difficult to stop them once they have their feet through the door.
Indeed, as you put it, single-minded pursuit of easily definable goals and ideological inflexibility combined with tactical acumen enable a specific individual to stand out and gain a following. It's true in politics, it's true in social media, but going through your work and seeing all of these, well, these stories, how these people achieve this power, often murderous power, what brings the power to an end, it brings us to Mr. Gorbachev, who's a very, very unique example of wielding power. He's someone who came to power in a totalitarian system and used his will to try to dismantle the very system that brought him power. What did you discover about Mr. Gorbachev in your research for the book?
Gorbachev is indeed an extraordinary figure, and he's one of the very few people in the book that I find sympathetic as an individual, as a character. Yes. But Gorbachev came to power in 1985 with the Soviet Union facing huge difficulties, economic and also in financial. And yet, it wasn't, most analysts agree, it wasn't likely to collapse within the immediate future. Had long-term problems which would have been difficult to overcome, but it didn't face imminent collapse. Gorbachev then sought to reform the Soviet Union. He was a dyed-in-the-wool Leninist, supported Lenin, supported the communist system, had grown up through, came to come to power within it, and he wanted to reform it. He didn't want to break it. And he quickly came to the conclusion that in order to change the economic system, which was malfunctioning, he had to change the political system. He introduced these two things, structural reform in terms of his perestroika, and freedom of, much more liberal freedom of speech in Glasnost, which were popular reforms. But what he found out within a couple of years, by 1987 or thereabouts, was that these reforms were running away with him. He couldn't any longer control them. And he spoke in his memoirs about that he'd lost control over the very forces that he'd unleashed. And by 1990, they were destroying him and actually destroying the Soviet Union. That's and right. By then, his popularity, which had been enormous at the start, was actually sagging massively until it collapsed totally. And so we have this ambivalent legacy of Gorbachev that, on the one hand, he gave freedom to millions in Europe. He helped, along with President Reagan, to halt, temporarily, it seemed anyway, to halt the nuclear arms race and to offer a new horizon, new freedoms to the whole of Europe, new peace to the whole of Europe by ending the Cold War. So yes. Gorbachev's achievement was massive, and yet at the same time, he destroyed his own country. And in a way, we're seeing the indirect legacy of that with Putin and Putin's war against exactly. Ukraine, which Putin was the indirect element of Gorbachev's legacy, which brought, first of all, the chaos of the Yeltsin years, and then, as a reaction to that, the onset to power of Putin.
Yes, people easily forget that there was an attempted Russian revolution just 30 years ago. But in closing, since you brought up Putin and Ukraine, if there's any one lesson I get from your book, it's that Putin, his choice to go into Ukraine will probably go down as a colossal mistake that destroyed his rule if it ends in defeat. But it seems that it's too early to tell, and Putin could still eke out a great big victory mark in the history books. Power, it seems, decides everything.
Yes, it's right. It's too early to tell. But that Putin's invasion of Ukraine was a mistake, a miscalculation of epic proportions, I think we can say that. But of course, we can't. One element of each of the chapters that I write on these individuals in the 20th century is I have a section dealing with their legacy. In the case of Putin and 21st century leaders, it's still too early to say what that legacy is, and we will have to wait for some time. And yet, part of that legacy is certainly, as you said, the miscalculation that's led to the destruction of so much of Ukraine, and how that war will end, nobody as yet can say for certain.
Cyrian Kershaw is the author of Personality and Power, Builders and Destroyers of Modern Europe. Thank you so much, sir. It's a completely fascinating book, and it made me really feel like I got a whole new perspective on all these historical figures that I didn't think I had anything left to learn about. So thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you for the excellent discussion and for your good questions. Thank you. It's very nice to talk to you. Okay, thank you.
And
bye-bye.
To you as well. Thank you. And we'll be right back.
This episode is brought to you by Philo. Do you love TV? Do you love saving money? Then Philo is your solution. Philo has shows, movies, and live TV for just $25 a month. You can even try it for free with their 7-day free trial. No contracts, no commitments, no hassles. Just a better way to watch TV. Never miss a minute of shows like the hit docuseries Where is Wendy Williams? Or classics such as Friends. If you can't get enough TV, then there's no better way to watch. Philo has more than 70 channels like BET, MTV, and AMC. And the best part? You can try it yourself with their 7-day free trial. Sign up today at philo.tv/poppods. That's philo.tv/poppods to get 50% off your first month.
What makes a life a good one? Is it the adventure you have? Or the friends you find along the way? Maybe it's pursuing your passion while striving to protect, defend, and save what you believe in every single day. So, what makes a life a good one? In the Coast Guard, we think it's all of the above and more. But you'll have to find out for yourself. Visit GoCoastGuard.com to learn more.
Welcome back. Imagine having one of the biggest, most prestigious, famous jobs in the world. Comfort, opulence for the rest of your life, but you can never live like a normal person. You can't love who you want. Your parents aren't close to you and they don't know how to be. You only get one promotion in this job for your life and you have to wait 70 years to get it. People of Earth, let's talk about King Charles III. Christopher Anderson is the critically acclaimed author of 18 New York Times bestsellers, which have been translated into more than 25 languages across the globe. A couple of his books, including The Day Diana Died and The Day John Died about JFK Jr., reached number one. You've probably read his stuff in many publications, ranging from New York Times to Life to Vanity Fair and, of course, his many media appearances. He is a prestigious expert on the royal family, has written extensively about it, and manages to make every conversation about the royal family sound impossibly intelligent and not in the least gossipy, which I've always admired. His new book is The King, The Life of Charles III, and it is a very frank, very honest, and very, in my opinion, caring look at one of the most complex and enigmatic figures of our time, Charles, who you don't get to call Prince anymore. It is an authoritative chronicle of his life. It is very, very honest, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Christopher Anderson to the show. Hello, sir.
Thank you. Hi. Thanks for having me.
Hi. Before we even start, let me ask. I just got back from London last week. How exhausted are you? Have you slept in the last 6 weeks, sir? It seems like it's been an exceptionally crazy time for someone in your line of work.
It has been. As a matter of fact, today, as you may know, the king and queen were pelted with eggs in Northern England.
Yes, I did. I heard all about that. Yeah, in going through your book, it's amazing. It brings back things I felt about Charles since I was a child and first became aware of him. A real compassion, a real sympathy for how awkward it seems he was predestined to be. It just sort of seems like he never had a shot at learning how to fake being a normal person. And I understand the critiques, but there's a lot of humanity in this book. And I'm really excited to talk about it with you. I guess the most obvious question is, what do people who don't watch The Crown and don't follow the royals, what do people need to understand about this man's particular childhood?
Oh, my God. Childhood is everything. You know, Winston Churchill, on meeting 3-year-old Charles and seeing that he's such a sensitive, pensive, introspective kid caught in this already at the age of 3, he said he says he's too young. He's young to think so much, is the way Churchill put it. But, it's very, very, it's nothing less than heartbreaking, I think, when you really consider the degree to which Charles was emotionally abandoned by his mother. We see in recent years, we've seen this very kind of touchy-feely relationship between the Queen and the then Prince of Wales. But yes, that wasn't always the case. I mean, there's that one encounter that I think says it all. I've talked about it before, but just really sums it all up. When Charles, 4 years old, goes to see his mother's been away for 6 months, her first tour of the Commonwealth, the young Queen. And she's celebrated, of course, internationally. She comes back and he rushes up to meet Mummy, but Mummy will have none of it and kind of shoves him aside because she has to greet the adult dignitaries. And when she finally does address him, she reaches down, and this was photographed, there's newsreels and everything, and shakes his hand as if he was a middle-aged man. And of course, you just contrast that with Diana, who would sweep, Harry and William up in her arms every time she was gone for, a weekend.
So, exactly.
Yeah, a big contrast. And, you know, there's one thing. I covered the 25th anniversary. This, you know, it makes me feel ancient, but I did cover the Silver Jubilee of the Queen in 1977. I was senior editor, actually, of People at the time, and running the Royals coverage there, among other things. But I just remembered the whole royal family coming into Westminster Abbey. And yes, they were historical figures almost, you know, but they were kind of, they had a waxworks quality about them. They really yes. weren't, as you pointed out, you know, multidimensional people. We didn't see them as human beings. And it really, this is 3 years before Diana was on the scene. So when she came, it, obviously everything changed. You know, she was just this whirlwind that altered the way the family functions and the way we perceive them. And there would never be a crown or my books or any particular interest. That's right. I mean,
yeah, Princess Anne couldn't do it all on her own. You know, nothing against Princess sure. Margaret either. Looking at the narrative, I've always felt this compassion for this gentleman, and mm-hmm. I find his stiffness so in contrast with his military service or his absolutely dynamic, forward-thinking commitment to climate science. But I have to remind myself in going through your text that this is a man whose mother became the monarch because literally you're not allowed to openly love who you want to love in this job. And the amount of fear that must be instilled on a cellular level when one's whole life is of being of service in a very public way where what you and I take for granted for freedom doesn't exist.
Right, right. And then we're seeing now, of course, the Harry and Meghan bringing that back to the forefront of everyone's minds. I mean, I think Charles, more than anyone, well, you know, I think he's the most paradoxical, complicated fellow to ever sit on the throne, to be quite honest,
with
her figure.
Because
the Queen, you know, because the Queen, of course, was, you know, she knew who she was. We knew who she was. It was all about duty, but not a very complicated woman. This guy has been through the ringer emotionally. And I write about, for example, his reaction to Diana's death, which I think would take a lot of people by surprise, you know, because he was completely shattered by it.
Yeah.
And there's this scene in the hospital where I interviewed the nurses who were there, and they saw him when he walked in the room and saw Diana laying in her coffin, her body for the first time. And, you know, he nearly passed out. It looked as if he'd been hit by an unseen force, as one of the nurses said. It just was staggering for him, but he rallied, you know. He sort of brought the monarchy to the brink of disaster by insisting on loving Camilla.
That's right.
And not give her up, right? And then after Diana's death, he saves the monarchy because the Queen was not, she was completely clueless about how important Diana was to her people. And
you're right.
As you may remember, all of that drama, you know, was the, and there was Charles at the center of it, you know.
I mean, Helen Mirren won an Oscar for playing the Queen in a film that was 100% about damage control. And, you know, I think that Charles had a lot of sympathy for this poor girl that he never should have married and how hard it was for her and to realize that he could never make things right for her. I'll never forget the funeral and being so impressed by how he and Prince Philip walked the streets behind the casket. And, you know, we should mention Prince Philip because Charles also had a very tortured relationship with his father, who he called brusque, harsh, and hectoring. It seems like this was an incredibly lonely childhood, and that's even before the physical abuse he went through.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, here's a little boy. He's down to these two schools, Cheam, and, you know, an English school, lower level school, and then Gordonstown in Scotland. But even, you know, prior, you have to look at the relationship just on a kind of a basic parental level. In that, here are some examples. I mean, when as a little boy had the flu, when he had a tonsillectomy, when he fell down the stairs and broke his ankle, when he had an emergency appendectomy, the appendix was on the verge of bursting, his parents never visited him in the hospital. I mean, the Queen stayed in bed in Buckingham Palace rather than get up and go see her little boy. As a matter of fact, Eleanor Roosevelt was visiting the night of the day after the operation, mm-hmm. the appendectomy had. And Eleanor Roosevelt was visiting the Queen, and when she realized that Charles was, you know, undergoing surgery, she was just shocked. I have it in the book about the Queen's indifference and lack of concern. You acted as if nothing was happening. So, and Philip was a bully. I mean, he repeatedly He reduced Charles to tears in front of other people. He made him feel, it was really the Queen Mother who came to Charles's defense, seeing him as a sort of a sensitive soul, someone who was very different from the rest of the royal family. Philip Cotton to Anne, as you know, Philip, mm-hmm. Anne had the kind of personality that Philip really appreciated, raucous and, that sort of thing. But he didn't really understand the introspective, thoughtful nature of his son. He saw it as a profound weakness. And the queen, in fact, to some extent, shared that belief, sadly, I think.
Yeah, and these are obviously these are things we've heard before, and for better or worse, the Crown has touched on them. But one thing that's in your book that really just I wasn't prepared for was the amount of torment and sadistic abuse he faced at school. I mean, the accounts of just the physical abuse, the emotional abuse from his peers, the being touched inappropriately by his peers. I mean, it's a wonder that he went through all this and came out with as much humanity as he has.
As a matter of fact, that's exactly what one of his fellow students who's named in the book said. It's amazing that he left with his sanity intact, that he emerged from that situation.
How bad was it for most who don't know?
Well, I mean, he was routinely, it's funny because you would imagine that everybody would, that a future king would be treated well by his peers as a boy. But no, if you got too close to Charles, you were considered a suck up, was the phrase they used. So it was really sport to torture him. And so basically, if there was a game, he was piled on and severely piled on by his fellow, even by his fellow teammates. At night, he was kicked in the head, punched in the head. He snored, so that made it worse. He was punched routinely. He was put in a kind of a cage and hung up in a shower and sprayed with ice water and left there. And then these things that hazing rituals of a sort that we would now consider abuse, outright abuse. That was just considered, in essence, part of that private school life. They public is a private school, boarding school life in Great Britain. It's he went through an awful lot. And of course, it's all revealed in his letters and it's revealed in the conversations that other people related to me. He would write to his parents, pleading to be taken out of the school. He called it worse. Years later, he said it was pure hell, the way he described it. He likened it to a Nazi prisoner of war camp. I mean, he never got over the fact that he was fundamentally abandoned by his parents.
Is the teddy bear story true?
Oh, yes. He still travels with the teddy bear. The teddy bear that he had as a small child is still there.
For 70 years, he's lived with this teddy bear for 70 years.
Yes. And the only person allowed to mend it over the years. Now, it's not true now because she's quite elderly. But until relatively recently, his childhood nanny, Mabel Anderson, was the only person allowed to basically touch it and, fix it up. And it needed a lot of fixing, as you can imagine, over 70 years. this quirky behavior there. I talk about in the book, for example, the fact that he has a tray of round ice cubes, a tray to make round ice cubes because he doesn't like the clinking sound that square ice cubes make. But that is something that the Queen and the Queen Mother did and Princess Margaret did as well. It's a thing in the royal family. They have a thing for round ice cubes. so it's very idiosyncratic. But and many other strange habits and quirks. The toilet seat that he traveled, he has a custom-made toilet seat that
he traveled
with.
I've heard about the toilet seat, yes.
And he was so incensed. Relatively, again, just a couple of years ago, he issued a formal statement saying it's not true. But right away, two ex-valets came forward and said, but it is, he does travel with the toilet.
We're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back. This is Progress.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
My guest is Christopher Anderson. He is the author of The King, The Life of Charles III. And I gotta ask you, once upon a time, you were a young person who presumably at some point knew nothing about the royal family. I'm curious, what happened that so captured your fascination and your professional drive?
God, you made it sound like it was so far back. Once upon a time.
Well, no, but it seems like you're not an old man. So I know that you've been doing this for a long time. You seem to have become fascinated at a young age.
I did, and I have to tell you, I am Charles' age, so I have a certain perspective. I can remember, and this may sound peculiar, but I was a Navy brat. My father was a decorated naval aviator, World War II guy, but this was his career. And so we traveled all over the place. And so I could remember people referring to, we lived in Japan for years and other places. But whenever anybody referred to the queen, it wasn't the queen of the country we were in, you know, or the empress or whatever. It was this. I remember realizing, oh, this is a person. This is a single, when you say the queen anywhere in the world, you mean Elizabeth. You really don't mean much of anything else. And so that stuck with me. And then when I became a reporter and I started reporting actually at 16 for a local newspaper in San Francisco, and then started working for Time, New York Times, when I was 18, and then Time Magazine the next year, and on and on. But the entire time I was fascinated by them. So when the opportunity came to be really handling all the some of the coverage of Time Magazine and People Magazine, I jumped at it. I just think they're amazing. You mentioned Princess Margaret. I tried to land an interview with her when she visited San Francisco many, many years ago, a very famous visit. And I was on the phone to her buddy, Charmaine Douglas, who was like her sidekick. And Margaret was in the other room, kind of, we were having this game of verbal ping pong. So I was trying to get a sit-down interview, which she wasn't giving them at the time. But it goes way back. If you want to know the minutia, that's the minutia.
How much has the Netflix series The Crown affected what you do and the world's perception of your subjects?
Well, isn't it fascinating that, you know, here we are, in a situation where, you know, there's nothing but drama and turmoil ahead. And yet what's already happened fascinates people. So I think what's going to be happening.
I agree.
I think people. Yeah. And there's this. I mean, if it hadn't been for Diana, I just don't think we would be in this position. I don't think they'd be appealing. We wouldn't have the storyline as it were. Right. It's a great saga. I'm just waiting to see what happens that day when the British people realize that Camilla is their queen.
You mentioned that before. I mean, as we have to get you, we're all in this process of getting used to calling him King Charles and not Prince Charles. And we're all having to unlearn that. But also, is it important to make the distinction that Camilla will be queen consort and not just queen? I mean, how important is that to the overall title?
Well, the consort thing is a bit of an invention. I mean, the queen, George VI, technically the queen consort, but she was never called queen consort. This is Elizabeth's mother. Elizabeth's mother was queen during her lifetime. Prior to becoming queen mother, she was Queen Elizabeth. So that is the title that really Camilla historically, I suppose, deserves. And that is what Charles is doing right now. He's trying to get rid of the consort in the title. So she will be officially and everywhere known as Queen Camilla. Now, she's going to be crowned next to him on May 6th. And that's going to be the moment that will be defining, I think, because I don't think the British people are happy with it or ready for it. I've been saying it for quite a long time, you know, because Charles promised, as you know, that she would never be queen. It was the only way he could sell. Yeah, the marriage, they're both divorced. I mean, you cannot, you know, until Charles came along, that was something, because he's the head of the Church of England, couldn't be done. Well, Henry VIII did it.
Right, but we look at all the hell that his granduncle was put through because he wanted to love the woman he loved. I think that over the decades that maybe a bit of goodwill was engendered for Camilla as the narrative that this is the woman he's always loved has permeated the public mindset.
Right, but then again, you have this memory of her as the woman who destroyed Diana, the marriage to Diana.
Of course.
Who must have schemed behind the scenes, you know, to some extent. She was married to Andrew Parker Bowles for 23 years, much of this relationship.
Yeah.
She always wanted to be, historically, you know, her great-grandmother, Alice Keppel, was Edward VII's mistress, famously. And when Edward VII died, Queen Alexandra called Alice Keppel to the king's bedside because she knew Alice Keppel was the one, the real love of the king's life.
Wow.
And I think that's what Camilla has always tried to do. I think she wanted to just replicate the experience of her of her great-grandmother. I don't think she in a million years thought she would become Queen of England. I think that was, you know, first of all, everyone in the royal family hated her.
Yeah.
You know, the Queen Mother, as long as she was alive, there was no way they were going to get married. And as and you know, Queen Elizabeth as well detested Camilla for causing so much trouble and getting in the way of it.
I can't imagine it'll help her PR too much if word gets out about this deal that Charles made with Camilla, that he made with the Queen to name her Queen Consort. That's something that I found, quite frankly, explosive in your book. I'm curious how you, when you get a story like that, first off, do you have to get other sources to corroborate? And I mean, it was very shocking to me. Can you explain to our listeners the deal that Charles allegedly cut with his mother to grant this title to Camilla?
Well, and again, it's unspoken. It's not, you know, it was an understanding, and also out by the famous the men in gray behind the scenes that really run everything that Diane used to talk about. A little context here. Camilla was the most hated woman in the realm when Diana died, and it took Charles 8 years to convince the Queen to let them marry, as I said, and he had to promise that she would never be anything but Princess Consort. But he never intended to keep that promise. I've written about that for years and years and years. He always intended to renege on this because it would be insulting to Camilla to not have the title that, you know, as the wife of the monarch. In his mind, that's the way he thinks. So, you know, he hammered away for 17 years after his marriage. The Queen routinely got an approach from Charles, you know, please, you know, get behind Camilla. She deserves to be queen. William and Harry heard it so often, they just were tired of hearing about it. Along comes the Jeffrey Epstein scandal and Prince Andrew's involvement in it. And Andrew, of course, is Elizabeth's favorite child, always has been, much to Charles's consternation. And the Queen wants to pay part of the $14 million settlement Andrew has to pay in a civil case related to the Epstein affair. Charles is against it. He's always been against helping Andrew out in this fashion and getting the crown involved. He thinks it's unseemly, to say the least. Mm. And the Queen really needed Charles to not object, which he could easily have done, because this money would eventually go to him, or it's her personal fortune. And so February 6th rolls around, and wouldn't this be the perfect time for her to announce finally on the anniversary of the actual anniversary of her 70th year on the throne, this would be the time to say you're behind making Camilla queen. And that's what happened. And it took everybody by surprise. Yeah, when she issued that statement, it was somewhat devastating to Harry and William. They didn't expect it. They were completely blindsided. And all palace watchers were like, what? How did this happen? Because we know how the Queen has always felt Camilla would cause problems if she became queen. There would not be a happy outcome in terms of the health of the monarchy.
You know, I'm someone who always resisted getting too into these personal stories, but then I married to a person who got really into the crown. And just as some folks like the tabloids, some folks like the more highbrow dramatizations. But on the subject of racism, you know, it's another area where I kind of have some sympathy for Charles. I remember about a year ago, I read an interview with you with the Daily Beast, where you were talking about Prince Charles worrying, like many old people do, you know, loved Meghan Markle, thought she was great, walked her partially down the aisle. But you told this story about how he benignly one time said to Camilla, I wonder what their children will look like. You know, and Camilla said, well, they're absolutely gorgeous, I'm certain. And the way you described it and set it up, completely innocent, no hostility whatsoever. But the headline in the Daily Beast was, in all caps, yes, Prince Charles really is the royal racist, author Christopher Anderson insists. Literally, if you read the article, it's the opposite of of what you say within the text.
Right, I know. I was somewhat dismayed. But I have to tell you, I'm a grandfather. I, as a grandparent, I can tell you, we all, and even parents, you know, you speculate on what your children are going to look like, innocently, benignly, and in a very positive and happy way. And that's what happened with Charles. So you're absolutely right. I said exactly the opposite. It was a comment that was just spun by the competing forces, because the palaces were always competing. I mean, everyone was, when the queen was on the throne, it was, William and Kate's people are over here, and Harry and Meghan are mainly just Harry most of the time, they married her. And, you know, these different little competing forces, camps, all vying for the attention of the queen and getting their own projects, pushed forward and that sort of thing. Those people behind the scenes turned it into something toxic. And by the time it got to Harry, quite definitely, they thought it was a racist remark, but initially it was not. I have several sources that were there for it. But that's
insane.
They're living in this whirlwind of intrigue still. Quite fascinating.
Their lives are completely insane. And that's something that you have a lot of compassion for, and it comes through in the writing. But before I let you go, I'm going to miss Charles with his environmental work. I've thought for a long time that was the most likable and dynamic thing about him. He was making speeches about climate change back before we called it that in the early 80s. How do you expect the coronation to go? Is this going to be good for him? Is he going to be okay in this job? He's getting eggs thrown at him already. Are you optimistic for him?
Is the honeymoon already over? It seems impossible. He just became king. I mean, let's cut him some slack here. Look, I guess also the economy is a bit of a problem. I have to say that the British economy, of course, is really in trouble. And a large section of the British public has some degree of resentment toward what they see as taxpayer money going to fund the lavish lifestyle of the royal family. What those people will not acknowledge is the fact that the monarchy really holds them together, the national identity. I mean, I thought they would have a collective nervous breakdown when the queen passed away, and because so much of who they are is right. And we all felt that way. It was just a surprise. Here's a 96-year-old woman. She's been doing this job for 70 years. And we were still all shocked when she died. We've all lived this life. I mean, who has been, as far as we're concerned, we've never been in a world without the queen in it.
Never.
So that's.
And who's more famous? So who's more famous on earth? Paul McCartney? Who's a more famous? The Pope, maybe.
Nobody. Right. The Queen of England was the most famous person of the modern age. There's no question about it. Now, Charles is on the road to becoming the same thing if he isn't already, just by virtue of who he is. A third of the planet is in the Commonwealth. He's on the money now. Or he will be.
He will be.
I think he's got a lot of problems to solve. I am somewhat apprehensive about the, I'm going to be there for the coronation on the 6th, but it's a moment fraught with history and pageantry and all the great things, but it's also going to be fraught with maybe some real trouble, because of the protests like the one we recently saw. And by the way, people forget that when at one point, and this was just before, got to get the timing right here, just before the wedding of William and Kate, Camilla and Charles were driving through central London in a royal limousine. It was a Bentley, and they were surrounded by a mob, which rocked the car and pounded on the windows and said off, and shouted off with their head. Wow. And to her credit, Camilla said her reaction was, "Well, there's a first time for everything." but there is, they're in a kind of a delicate position there.
I'll say, and no matter what, my estimation of this very enigmatic man is forever changed by what I've learned about his tormented and painful childhood. There's so much humanity in this book. Christopher Anderson, thank you so much for joining us. Please come back anytime. I'd love to go even deeper. We didn't even touch on his military record. The book is The King, The Life of Charles III. Thank you so much for joining us on SiriusXM. I can't wait to see what comes next.
Oh, thank you, John. I really had a great time.
Thank you.